Tell me your position with the BLM. How's that?
It was always worked in the public room.
Yeah.
Yep. It's went to work there in what, December of 1961, and was going for a couple of years in the mid 60s, and then worked until about this time or so of 1985. Yeah, it was different. I don't know if you've been out to the public room out here, but don't bother. You can't find anything out. It's all on the computer, and it's up to what you tell this guy to put in the machine. So it's really tough to find nothing historical. I asked for a case file just in the last 3 or 4 months. I needed to see something, and they said that the archive people had tossed all the old, which I can't imagine. I can't imagine tossing patented ground and stuff, these case files, which are historic. And I'm just not sure if, I got the right word out here. I can't imagine they would toss them. Have you been to the archives that's in Anchorage? A lot of the old patented cases are there, but most of them had been in the Seattle area, and then the old patents were in Washington, D.C.
Well, let's go back to the 60s.
Yeah.
What was going on with the public room at that time? People walking in?
The people that had to do with mining only came in to check the status of the land. You had nothing to do with the BLM if you wanted to stake a mining claim. That didn't happen until the 70s when ANILCA, when they had the lands legislation, which then required you to bring a copy of your location notice into the BLM. So that wasn't until late in the game. But in the 60s, you could come in and check the status, and then you would stake the claim and file it strictly with the recorder's office.
Were there a lot of federal claims being staked in the 60s?
Oh, yeah, there were, but they had nothing to do with the BLM. You only came to the BLM if you wanted to apply for patent.
Yeah.
So there weren't any. And then it really got crazy when you had to file a copy of your... So if a guy, someone had claims were based on buying it here, you had to come in with the original location notice in 1910 and 1927. And if you were unable to find it, the statute of limitations, I think, was 7 or 11 years. You can check that out. If you could show that you had filed affidavits of labor and were in possession of that ground, or whatever the statute of limitations was, then that was good enough. You didn't have to come up with the location notice. But an awful lot of people did. They would have a location notice, a quitclaim deed 10 years later, a quitclaim deed 10 years later, and they would have a chain of title for 40, 50 years. It was crazy. But you didn't have to. You could show if you were in possession of the ground for 10 years or whatever the statute of limitations is, you were okay. And then from then on, you still had a file originally with the recorder's office, and a copy came to the BLM. Yeah.
Was there a lot of patents being given in the 60s?
Not many patent applications. No, there weren't. But there were always patent applications on file. They would have to go to, and at that time, there was only one mineral surveyor. I can't even think of his name now, but you had to get the mineral survey done, and then all these papers, and then that's what you filed with the BLM. And there were ones being filed largely with larger companies. Not many small people. It was just too expensive to do it, yeah. And you didn't really have many mining lawyers that could help you out very much, because it had been a long time since they had very many patent applications.
Mm-hmm. I remember that thing with the homestead. A lot of people came up here looking for homesteads.
That's right. Yep. And if it was unreserved public land, if it was unsurveyed land, you filed a location notice, like same as a mining claim, or you would stake it out, and you had 90 days to cover that you know, your occupation, you had to file with the BLM within 90 days. If you didn't file within 90 days, you lost the advantage of that settlement that you had. But if in the meantime, the state had selected the land, you were out of luck. But you could stake that, and if it was on surveyed land, you asked to be on. You filed an application to enter. So you filed with the BLM. The BLM would check to see is it viable for locatable minerals, oil and gas, and that stuff. And if everything was okay, then you would be given a notice of allowance, which started your five-year statutory life. Whereas with a location notice, the 5 years started with the day you filed with BLM.
Were people actually, I think I remember you telling me that they were getting that homestead for the land, not for an agricultural use.
Oh, no, they were just filing on the land to acquire land. That's right. They just thought it was a neat and a free way to acquire land, but hardly anyone was, agriculture. Although there were a bunch in the early 60s, middle ones, that filed around Delta before the state selected it, who actually had farms. They did. A lot of them did. And they stayed there and they grew stuff. But not many. Most of them just wanted to acquire lands. And it could be that more home sites and headquarter sites than that were filed than homesteads. Because the ones that filed out and gone wouldn't file homesteads. They'd file home sites or headquarter sites. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Easier to prove up on that, too. No agriculture. Just had to have, just live on the land for 5 months a year for 3 years. Oh. And a headquarters was just 5 acres in connection with the business. Yeah.
It was a transition time, wasn't it? The statehood had been passed.
That's right.
But
that's
the
right.
State...
And what they had selected early on was just way up north, you know, where the oil was and stuff. But they would select it, and like all around Fairbanks, and I'm sure around other locales, they would just sort of top file. We say, we are going to file our state selection application for all land available at this time in Township 1 North, Range 1 East. So that would fall into place, and you wouldn't see. You'd have to look at a status plat to see what might have been open when they filed it. But then after that, you couldn't file anywhere, and the only difference would be is if there was a homestead in 1 North, 1 East, and someone filed a contest complaint against it, and they were successful, they were allowed the right to enter that land, and the state selection could not fall in on it. So a lot of people did file contest complaints against homesteads because they were given the right. In fact, that's, I'm sure, the very last homestead patent. It was the guy that was a hotshot with DOT. I can't think of his name right now, but he filed out in the middle of nowhere, way out south and west of Manly Hot Springs or someplace like that. He filed a contest complaint, was successful. I know who he filed it against, Barbara Winkley. Of all things, I remember her name because it was close to Hinckley and Binkley and Winkley. So he was successful. He filed, he proved up. And I think that his patent was issued by the federal government and he didn't. I don't even know if he had to file final proof because what they said is, we're going to quit all this filing on land. And if you got an application out there and you're proven up, so I'm pretty sure that he... That'd be interesting to see. And that you could find out, if I can remember his name, you could ask them to punch that name into the machine and they would give the cell number. But at any rate, that was...
Was that one of the last homesteads then?
Oh, I'm sure it was. If there might have been later ones in the Anchorage District, but I somehow doubt it. It seems to me that there was a woman who came up here from Nebraska 8 or 10 years ago. And she was just wanted to talk to people that still lived on their homesteads and various things. And she and I went out to visit Howard Luke at his allotment across the river. And she said that when she was in the office in Anchorage, that there was a patent issued later. But then when I looked up that guy's history, there were a lot of problems with the filing of the final proof and stuff. So his application, his filing was much earlier than the one here. But the patent was later just because there were so many problems with witnesses and final proof and all that kind of stuff.
Was this the late 60s then, this last
well,
one?
Well, no, the time that she was up here was in, well, and then she went back to look at the records, but it was in the 80s. After 85. 86 is when they said, no more. So, and that's this patented homestead, which I think is the oldest homestead to file that went to patent, was probably in the mid-80s. I think his would have been 80. Well, I still worked at the BLM, so it had to be before June of 1985.
Well, that transition period when the state was trying to select things, and
right.
Was there much cooperation going on, or just...
The state just selected it. They would send people over to just, you know, check the status to see what might be part of a national park or something. Because the downside for them for not having, they didn't have computers, they had to check like anybody else had to check. I wonder what's available out there, or is there... And then when the claim settlement act, all so much land was withdrawn in December of 1971 that, you know, they couldn't select within the village withdrawals and all that. They could not, but they, what they did with the village withdrawals, alternate townships were, first of all, depending on the population, it was for the village to select. And then alternating townships were for the region to select, and alternating townships for the state to select. So there's a
checkerboard.
Yeah, all over the state. But the state, and then after a while, they just simply they wouldn't file on if land was part of a national interest thing. They would have someone check to see if it was okay. Yeah. But then they had to start selecting. Because, you know, suddenly there were, certain lands were set aside if there wasn't enough for the village court, for the regional corporation to be able to select within a village area, they had to select outside then. That's how the CERI selected the federal building, you know, the old post office.
Yes.
They acquired that because there simply wasn't enough acreage around for them to select.
Right.
So they got to select improved stuff. They got some old federal installations in Key West, for God's sakes. It was really crazy.
Yeah. Right. So the state was selecting a lot of the mineral-rich lands, it seemed to me.
That's right.
And
that's right.
So the miners had the choice then to go from their federal claims to a
that's
state
right.
claim?
But if they preceded the state selection, they could continue theirs. And I'm sure there are many, many mining claims that have been kept current that preceded, a state selection 30 years ago. But the day they would not file their affidavit of labor, the day they lost the claim, it would become part of the state selection. The state wouldn't have to amend their selection. It would just become part of it.
Yeah.
But there were plenty of ground that's why they had to check the status to see, should I file a state or a federal claim? Yeah.
So your office was pretty busy with people coming in and looking through your records.
Especially after after they had to record their claims. That was a zoo. Did you ever, we were on Fort Wainwright at that time. This would have been, the Claim Settlement Act was December 71. It was 76, I think, 5 or 6, where all of the D2 selections and all that stuff happened. And then they had to file, after a certain date, they had to file all of their federal claims with us. And they were pouring in so much stuff by mail, but hundreds and hundreds of them in person. Because I think a lot of them, if what they had was a long chain of title going back to 1925, they wanted to come in and do it in person to see if what they had was okay. Because to do it by mail would be pretty tough. But it was a zoo. It was a zoo for a year or so. Yeah, it was a long time. But it was a lot of fun. But it was busy. Yeah. Yep.
I'm surprised those federal claims, mining claims, because they're half the size of the state claims, mm-hmm. people really still wanted them.
But you could file as many as you wanted. I mean, just because it was 1330 by 660, didn't mean you couldn't file 26 of them in one day. You know, if you staked them out, you could file. There was no limit to how many you could file.
But didn't it have to be like association with involved rather than just one name?
No, one person could file, you know, just like the FE company could file all they wanted. Joe Vogler could file all he wanted. There was no limit.
Wow.
Yeah. And so if you liked a particular creek and no one else there, you'd file on 3 miles of the river. Crazy.
Yeah.
You had to, of course, the filing, you know, the affidavits of labor was, nobody ever checked that out until they filed the patent application. But, you know, it was really funny. This one woman from Kobuk, and her sister lived here, so that her brother-in-law, this guy, would, she'd been told by her dad years ago that you should keep this valuable someday. And she would have her fish camp or something out there, and she understood him to say that you had to do 100 hours of work on each claim. So she was just really honest, and she would do 100 hours. So finally, about the second or third year, her brother-in-law, I said, no, it's $100. And you can just lie about it. You know, you can just say $100. God, I used to know her name, too, because it was a neat name. And she did. She did 100 hours worth of work. But that's all you had to do. You could stake as many as you wanted. And if they were contiguous claims, you could do all of it on the discovery or all of it on one. If you had 10 claims, you could do $1,000 on one claim that would do for the benefit of all of them.
Wasn't the older system, though, that the discoverer would get the discovery claim plus one more on that creek? No,
you get as many as you want. There was never a limit on how many you could have.
No.
And I'm not even sure you had to have a discovery to, you know, you said you did, but you could file, you know, as many as you want. I don't think there was a limit.
Interesting. So besides these miners coming in with their claims, what are the typical kind of people walk through the door?
Well, don't forget that in the 60s, oil and gas was a huge thing.
Oh, yeah, right.
It was really, really big because the areas up north were federal, and they had, BLM had a third Monday list. Lands that became open to filing for oil and gas leases, the third Monday of every month, they would post where these were. And other ones, if it was this unreserved public land, you could file an oil and gas lease application. And when I first, in the 60s, if you got the lease, God, what was it? You paid like $25. I'm not sure. It was nothing. It was $25 an acre, and it was, the biggest it could be was 2560. You know, the four townships would be the size of four sections, I should say. And you had to, when you got the lease, then you paid this rental. But the rental was originally, when I first worked there, it was $25, and then you got the next 2 years for free, and then it was 50 cents an acre. It was so, which was nothing. So when all these local guys made the big bucks, Charlie Cole and, you know,
Berglund,
Berglund is really good. Well, he knew what he was doing, but he got state and federal. But he did a lot with federal too. Hmm. But it was Stroker, and they were so loosey goosey. I don't know. No one ever audited the banks. Here's the way it worked. On one of these big drawings, there might be 50 people filing on this one. Well, they would make a drawing. And if that person was eligible, they'd issue the lease. And when they issued the lease, all the rest of them got their certified check back. So Stroker, knowing that, he loaned money to people. Gas station attendants could borrow $10,000 because he knew they would either get a lease, in which case they would sell it if they paid 50 cents an acre. You know, a week later, before they even issued the lease, they would sell it to an oil company for $2.5, $3, $3.5 an acre. So he would get his money back, and it did work out. But, you know, can you imagine he loaned money to people that had nothing. But he knew he would get the money back if they didn't get a lease. And if they got the lease, they would be paid back. Mm-hmm. So it was crazy. Mm-hmm. And they had drawings in the Lacey Street Theater, up on the stage mm-hmm. of the Lacey Street Theater. Yeah. And there would be people, they were on Second Avenue then, and the oil companies, Shell and all the big companies, the doors to the Lathrop building opened at 8 o'clock, and the open for filing at 10 o'clock in our office on the third floor. They would be out on the sidewalk before 8 o'clock to come in first, and they would line up and have their little... And then they would come up and stand in line at the accounts office to file their application of lease, and then stand in line again for 2 hours up there in the Lathrop building. It was really bizarre. And that went on for at least 2 or 3 years. And a lot of people, a lot of local people here made a lot of money. Charlie Cole was always smart. He sold his, if you paid 50 cents, he didn't mind taking the 250 or three. His brother, Dick, got a little greedier. And many times he held out for more money, and then suddenly they wanted the second year rental. And then he didn't necessarily want to pay it. Sometimes he paid it every year, and no one ever asked him for to have it assigned to him. And in the bar room at the most popular bar room to wheel and deal and trade was the one there on Noble Street. I forget what it's called now, but it was the other motel and the bar. It was what is now this big one, Travelers. The nice restaurant. Yeah, Travelers Inn.
Yeah.
That was where much of the negotiating was done. In the Travelers Inn.
So then came along the 1971 Native Claims Settlement. Did that affect your office much?
Yeah, sure. Suddenly it really poured in. They knew that this was going to happen. So the BIA, and they hired everyone, went out to every village. Up until then, the way you filed a Native allotment, the BIA, until the mid-60s, had one realty officer, and he was a jerk and was stationed in Juneau. So you could tell where he went. If suddenly the people in Chalkitsik sold a lot of beaded slippers, that's where he had gone. He never did get to any Inupiat. He never got up north. So one day they started having realty people in 62, 3, 4. So they helped people file the Native allotments. But then, when they knew the Claims Act was coming, and they knew that it was going to do away with the Allotment Act, they poured in. They went all over the state, and ours was like, not just the north half of Alaska, ours was from, Bethel was in the Fairbanks district then. It changed, but we, and the BIA, and they had all these people that were just out getting descriptions of land and stuff, so that was really busy. Tons of Native allotments came in. And then, with the Claim Settlement Act, there was no more Native allotment. That ceased. In fact, you couldn't file anything. And of course, the reason that they finally signed the Native Allotment Act was the pipeline. If that hadn't happened, they would never have done any negotiating with it. Because there were so many assertions of rights by the Native groups. And suddenly the oil companies went and said, we couldn't issue a pipeline right away because of the assertion of rights. They said, why don't you do something? So they had a settlement act, and then they issued the very first public land order in the Alaska Claims Act, not the Native Claims, but the one withdrawing land for D2 and for states and all that stuff, was the pipeline withdrawal. PLO 5150 was the very first one written, so they could get along with the... it was pretty funny.
So that period, BLM was doing a lot of the surveying for the village,
had to do all the surveys for not just the town site. The town site always had been surveying, because they would petition to have town sites, but there were only a handful of allotments from those areas, but yes, before you could issue a certificate of allotment, the ground, just like for a homestead or home site, had to be surveyed. So, God, they'd be... The villages were just full of BLM surveyors most years. And that, just think of that job. These guys would just go out there, and the thing is, it took a while. It took several years for these white surveyors to get used to the fact that, you know, you... It's a long day in Kobuk. And not necessarily start at 8 o'clock in the morning and quit at 5. No one might be moving until noon, and then they'd work till 2 o'clock in the morning. So that's when they wanted to go out and show you their allotment. So these guys had to get local to survey when it was available.
Yeah. Yeah.
But they did a lot of work, a lot of surveying. I think they still are, I'm sure. There are plenty of allotments that have never been surveyed. Yeah.
Some of this was started before GPS also. I don't know how they did those ground surveys.
No, you put stakes. No, you just walked it with these transits and stuff. No, that's the way they did it until probably the 70s or 80s. I mean, for a long time, they just brushed out lines. They were lucky to go way up north or out west because there weren't trees. If it were the place, yeah, you had to get a clear sight. Can you imagine? It is just crazy. Yeah. Yep.
I think later on they just used helicopters to drop in the
corners.
That's right.
Oh, yeah, and that is much more accurate than the other ones. Yeah, and they did. I think that's what they've been doing for quite a few years.
Yeah.
Yeah, God, that's crazy.
Yeah.
Yep.
Well, the last one, the last area is the Nilka, the 1980 big land withdrawals.
Right.
D2,
right,
as they called
right.
it. Yeah. Did that impact your office much?
Well, not really, because that was just filed by the Park Service, and we would just get descriptions of what was to be withdrawn, we put on our records, but it didn't. No one really came in to our office. It was really funny how early on the assumptions in that, and which was the Secretary of Interior who came up here to visit, and...
Was it Udall?
I don't think it was. I think it might have been... What? He might have come up. But anyway, one of them went up, and the Park Service people or some federal group just assumed that everything, when you get out and gone, everything was just federal land. And they went up to one of these beautiful lakes way up north of the Brooks Range. And there was this, you know, you could tell that someone had been camping there and doing stuff, but they had seen this place, these Park Service type people, so that's where they took him. And all of a sudden this guy shows up, why are you on my allotment without asking my permission? They couldn't believe that. Yeah, you can. And it's this great guy, there's again, I'm getting bad on names, he's a guy from Kotzebue. That's a long way away.
Yeah.
And he went everywhere. And he had four parcels in his allotment. And of course, they said, well, why are you in this part of the lake? He says, well, look around you. The rest of it's crap. This is the most beautiful part of this lake, and this is why I'm here. And that was really neat. But that was, it did help them to see that maybe there are people out there using the land that we didn't know about. Yeah. Yeah. God, I can't think of his name. But he was a neat guy. In fact, he had one of these heart valves. And, you know, they used to have on the radio, and that was, you know, the trap line chatter and stuff.
Yeah.
And they would have, you know, Fred Rabinowitz, he's got to, don't forget to have your thing checked. Yeah, it would be on the radio, and this guy might be taking his, snow machine 300 miles across the middle of nowhere. Yeah, it was really cool.
Yeah.
Wow.
So things kind of slowed down in your office over time?
They slowed down after the big allotment push, because they did away with it. Well, we were still plotting them on the records and stuff for at least a year after December of 1971. But then as soon as that was up, we started getting the location notices for the mining claims. So it was very busy then. But then after that, after they had all gotten recorded, it slowed down a lot. people still filed. One of the neat things that kept people coming in just to check the status. I don't know if you remember, but we put out a map of Alaska. It's this big by this big, and a township with 23,000, you know, acres in it. 6 miles by 6 miles was about this big.
Mm-hmm.
And what we did was color code them. Green would be parks, a certain color would be allotment areas, and yellow was unreserved public land. So suddenly there was this map. So people would come in, and of course, the original pipeline withdrawal wasn't where it is now. In fact, where they proposed it to be in one of the first places that it changed was near Delta Junction, and it was on the other side of the river. It was on there, and so it wasn't going through up here, and it stayed on the south and on the west side of the river going up. Well, that wasn't the way, and then we still had this map up on the wall. But as we told people, we said, you got to check the status plan. You guys don't pay any attention to that, because there were a lot of errors on it. So, funny one, and that land, when it changed, we had on that map yellow, not over there on the side that we had it, and so it changed to the other side of the river. So we had yellow over here, but the yellow, what was open was across the river. So, and no one paid any attention or didn't, you know, there were a lot of people in Delta and Tok that wanted to file. And this woman came in, and her husband was a big wheeler dealer in Delta. He had all sorts of businesses and a land acquisition and stuff. And so she would happen to be in Fairbanks doing other stuff, and he had asked her to check to see if he could get a timber permit across the river. So we whip open all these bikes and say, hey, a timber permit? He can have anything. He can have a homestead there. She said, oh my God, that's a lot. So what she did was go back to Delta and pass the word to everyone but her husband that you could file. And I mean, within a month, it was filled up with homesteads. Most of them went to patent too. And she didn't tell him, because he said, the last thing I want to do is be a homesteader's wife, you know, and go across that stupid river and stuff.
Yeah.
But that's what it was. So people were constantly checking. The best story was Boyd Haynes. This guy wanders into the office one time, you know, when within a month or so of when suddenly there was unreserved public land you could file on, probably in the summer of, what would it be, 75 or whatever the year it was. This old guy with just raggedy clothes on, and he asked the status of it, and he pointed to a place west of what the Denali Park boundaries were then. Well, in the middle of nowhere, in the Kuskokwim, and he just asked what the status of that was. And he'd been living there since 1940. He'd come up here and just went out there and stayed, and what his house was just a tent with about three layers of space. I mean, it was bare bones stuff. So I said, yeah, that's unreserved public land. You can file. He said, well, yeah. So he figured out a description, and I said, now you're going to... He said, are you a veteran? He says, yeah, World War One. Now, a World War One veteran, a World War Two got certain freebies. You only had, if you were over 24 months in the service, instead of living on it 7 months a year for 3 years, you could do just 1 year, and you could get away without cultivating a couple of years. Well, a World War One veteran, if you established residence and lived on there 7 months the first year and filed final proof within the first year, you get a patent. No cultivation, no more residence. So that's what he did. So he came back in again, you know, a year later to file a final proof, and he had witnesses and stuff. And I said, well, I'll send to St. Louis where the records are and get your, your discharge. You know, that's not me. And he had one of these trucker's wallets on a chain. And he took out, and this is what, 1970-something. And he took out his discharge papers. And they've been folded so much they were kind of cracking and stuff. But I xeroxed them. And then what was really sick he filed it. It was in the Fairbanks district when he filed it. And then they changed the district boundary to make it a little more equal, and more of it went to. And there were a little more chicken shit in Anchorage, so. But I knew most of the people that worked there. And he filed his final proof and said if the homestead was supposed to be adaptable to agriculture. Well, some chicken shit person went out and said, well, I don't think that's really a, I said, oh, come on. Who cares about 160 acres in the middle of nowhere? And this guy is old. And I knew enough of the people that were going to be adjudicating. I said, come on. He got the patent. But his name was Boyd Haynes, H-A-Y-N-E-S. And when he was sitting there, he said, you know, it's always bothered me that on all the USGS maps, they spell it H-A-I-N-E-S. I said, hey, I send stuff to the geographic place names all the time. It's no problem. I'll just tell them. And so the next time there was an inch to 4 miles first, and then finally there was an inch to the mile, they would correct it. But then, when they would make another map 3 or 4 years later, it'd be HAI. Well, you know Donald Orth? Have you ever seen Orth's geographic place name? And he is the last word on everything. He was up here. Did you go hear him? He's just terrific, and he was just great. But in the book, if you look up Haynes, H-A-I-N-E-S, the two guys, and I knew those two guys. In fact, the one guy's son comes up and visits. That's who they said, yeah, that's Haynes Lake. You know, he was asking, what do you call that? Like, it's Haynes Lake, Boyd Haynes. So he spelled it in geographic place names, H-A-I-N-E-S. So every time there would be a change in the map, the cartographer was told to say, now, if you have any questions on any of the names of the geographic places, check with Orth's book.
Yeah.
So they'd look in there and say, oh, they got H-A-Y.
Yeah.
Yeah. So poor old Boyd went to his grave with one of them correct and the other one not. Now, here's one of the things that's good about all the computer age. That is now in the system saying, this is H-A-Y-N-E-S Lake. So, with luck, I should go up to the USGS office and look at those two maps. It should be H-A-Y-N-E-S.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Yeah. But this guy walked in out of nowhere and had been sitting there for, God, I don't know, 35 years.
Yeah. Let's go back to that map, because I remember that map. It had different colors.
Yep, that's right.
Tell me the colors again.
Well, the green, the dark green was for the federal withdrawals, parks, and that sort of thing. The yellow was open lizard, public land. The blue was state. And then, I don't know what the other ones were. God, there should be, gotta be a native, there'd be a copy
pink.
Of that map.
There was pink.
Was there a pink?
That was a native.
Oh, what was it? Oh, you mean the withdrawals around villages and stuff? Maybe so. Yeah. And it was on, you know, they should have a map. They should have one in a tube somewhere at the BLM.
I think so, but I doubt it.
But
there was a dark green and there was a light green, which was the tentatively selected, I think. You know, they kind of had, like, the state had the light blue and the dark blue. You know, the dark blue was the...
What was selected and was tentatively approved.
Yeah, yeah.
And I didn't know there were two shades of green. What were the light... The dark green was parks and...
Yeah, they were established.
That sort of thing,
yeah.
But I don't know how they would know that this is possibly a state withdrawal.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if they still have that around. You'd think they would have... save that in those little tubes, but we don't.
Yeah,
we don't keep things in tubes anymore. Mm. Yeah.
So the yellow was what you were dealing with.
That was meant to be unreserved public land. You could file a homestead on. That's right.
Yeah.
That's what it was meant to be.
Yeah, or of mine.
And by and large, it was. It gave you a good idea of where to look, and there were so many places like. West of here, Green Lake and those places, that was all unreserved public land out there, south and west of Manly Hot Springs. And then there was a bunch of land north and west of Tanana that was open. A lot of people filed there. Not many homesteads, but home sites, T&M sites, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Now, with a T&M and a headquarters, The difference was you paid the cost of survey, whereas with homesteads and home sites, you didn't. But the cost of survey wasn't that much, but that was the difference, that you would pay whatever the survey cost was.
Those leftover lands, I've heard them said characterized as glaciers and mountaintops. It doesn't sound like they were, though.
I don't think so. No.
Yeah. But, I mean,
no, they just... In fact, a lot of it was good stuff, like the stuff across from Delta. You know, it's just that it wasn't spoken for. And if anything, it helped that map did not show yellow, that it was unreserved. Because it was probably 6 months until she came in to find out. Mm-hmm. But, no, I think there was a lot of good stuff, and especially out and gone. A lot of stuff that was wilderness land that was just fine, but, mm-hmm. you know... Who wanted to try to get there?
Isn't it still that way? I mean, there's still...
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Like a third of the state, basically, is unreserved.
Oh, yeah, there's a lot that never was spoken for, which is probably beautiful. Yeah, it's...
But there's no way for individuals to do anything with it. They can just enjoy it.
That's all. They'll never be able to acquire anything from the federal government. And I don't know what the state's rules are. They have to classify lands as suitable... And I don't know, I think you can petition that they file some, but I don't know how effective that is.
My point is that everything's fixed pretty much now. After
it
the
is.
That
it is.
D2.
Anilka, the 1986 thing, that's pretty...
Yeah.
Yeah, everything is certain, it is set. And the only way they could change it is if the state convinced them to remove the withdrawal of, parks or something like that, just like, I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You were there during a real interesting time.
It was really great. It really changed, and there was a lot of different kinds of activity. Yeah, it was really, really something. Yeah. And when they were doing all that oil and gas, which was at least for 2 or 3 years, 62, 63, 64, that office was just full of landsmen, people who work for the oil companies, checking the status and stuff. In fact, Marianne Nichols worked for Pan Am, who was right across the street above where, directly across the street from, there was a bar up there, and the Pan Am office was just above there. And she came over in her lunch period, and there was a wheeler-dealer guy who filed oil and gas leases. He'd had a sporting goods store, and then he got interested in oil and gas, and he was very clever. And he would ask her to go over and check the books, go through the books just like these landsmen did, and say, were certain, had leases been dropped, had people filed on, because you would file between 10 and 4, and then we updated the records by hand in these serial books and stuff. And she would come over and check and then contact him. In fact, there's a good book, I don't know if you've read it, it was written by the guy who's still around, and he was an oil and gas type, and he was even the mayor of Anchorage for a while. And she, not by name, but the guy was in the book, so the fact that he had someone coming over and checking the record, and it was Mary Ann. And what he did one time was, you filed for an oil and gas lease in five copies, but you got the form from the BLM. And he went over and in a week's time got every single copy of the application forms from the office in Anchorage. And then the only way, and when they ran out, they had to order more from the printing office in Denver. So he was the only one that had the form for about a month or something like that. It was really crazy. And I don't think he got in any trouble for it. He just said, I needed the forms. But it was, full of people. And they just all were checking the status of lands to see. Mm-hmm. And the state had selected a lot early on up there, but other reasons... They were checking to see if leases had been dropped. if a person had not paid the rent, then shortly thereafter it would show on the records as unreserved public again, not mm-hmm. subject to lease. Yeah. And they were, many of them, the longer they kept coming in, the nicer they were. They were, but they were by and large jerks because they were so upset that, and there'd be another person that worked in the public room, that we'd be talking to some scruffy guy with the home site, you know, out by Tuntutuliak, or to some native allotment guy, and not quit and go over and talk to them. But they, the longer they kept coming, which was for 2 years, they were there often, they got better. Well, they got used to us. So they felt they know us.
Yes. Your office was on 2nd Avenue when I first saw you.
That's right. It was on 2nd Avenue until it was in November of 1972, and then moved out to Aurora from 72 to 78, and then to the base, 78, and I retired in 85, and I think they were there another couple of years before they moved to where they are now.
Yeah. That office you had on 2nd Avenue, though, I remember you leaning out the window and
sure.
saying hi to people.
Oh, yeah.
You
were
up in the second,
third floor. And facing 2nd Avenue. Oh, it was great. Yeah, it was a neat office, really handy. Yeah.
Yeah, well, that was when the downtown was a real live place.
That's right. That's right, and they had a sweetheart deal, a long-term, and the BLM directors used to always want to change it to move to a groovier place and that kind of stuff. And the Interior Department said, not on your life, you know, we're paying 20 cents and, you know, we're paying nothing compared to what it would have been with the new one. And then suddenly, one time in this 1972, and I'll let you guess for a while to see who suddenly became the Secretary of the Interior. And the Burgess Company, this was at betting on the come for the pipeline in the late 60s, because they discovered the oil in 68. So everything was going crazy. And they had the sort of that haul road. We'd go up, and Burgess was going to bet on the come. He wanted to have all of his equipment parked up by Weisberg somewhere so they could build the bridges and do all this stuff. And they parked it, but with all the assertion of rights, nothing happened. And he was going broke. And he had that building out in Aurora and kept trying to sue, and they were not going to. But suddenly an ex-governor, I'll give you a hint, the next governor was the Secretary of Interior. Huh? And with a magical El Bailo Auto, which some people called it, we moved into this thing. It was not a tall setup for an office like ours. It was just stupid. And we were there for six years. But that was to bail out Burgess. Yeah. But actually, Hickel did better things for than you would think a Nixon appointee would have done. In fact, he got fired because he wouldn't let him build an airport in the Everglades. He said, well, no, that's not right. We're not gonna. Yeah. And they were so shocked that so he was sacked.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's enough for now. How's that?
Yeah, yeah. I'm trying to think of that guy's name that I think had the last name. It wouldn't be hard to find out.
Well, it's such an amazing time.
It was all anachronism. You know, people associate homesteads with a John Wayne movie or something. They just had no idea, because you had stopped being able to file homesteads. Well, you had to classify the land in the lower 48. But I think in the late 30s, you couldn't file homesteads anymore. And you never could file the home sites, headquarters sites, and T&Ms. They were strictly Alaska type filings. Yeah.
When did the ruling come down for Alaska to stop homesteads? 60 sometime.
It was 86.
Oh, 86.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my God.
Like I say, this guy had filed on the one that he got patent to before I left, which was in June of 1985. And he got patent after, but he filed the homestead then.
I thought a lot of them were just refiling on older homesteads that hadn't been picked up.
Not really. Now, the only way you could identify where there had been a is on surveyed land. There are only a handful of them were on. If it was unreserved public land, you just put stakes in the ground. So, and if you just looked at our records and saw on the historical index, the description would say M and B, meets and bounds. Well, unless you read that and tried to figure out where it was, it didn't mean anything. So if a person founded a township, had three, you know, was available for filing homesteads, they would just see where ones had been filed and then go out. And on the ground is what counts.
Yeah.
If the description was inaccurate, it's what's on the ground that would count.
Yeah.
Descriptions. Howard Luke and his family had lived where their place is now for, I mean, his mother and father had had it before him. And when I think the dad died, and it was in, within the boundary and gunnery division, so no one else could file, but they predated it. And they contacted the BIA, contacted the mother way, way back before I ever worked there. Said, you should file on that. Said, oh no, it's only for the head of the family. I'm not, Howard should file on it. So he didn't bother, and it wasn't important because he was protected. It was within the bombing and gunnery range. No one else could file. And that's where Binkley took the boat, remember? He took the boat down there and dump off people. They'd watch him eat breakfast. And, and there must have been eight or nine camps from Minto that were there in the summer, and they would sell beaded stuff and birch bark. And so it was pretty interesting thing. So Binkley finally said, yeah, you got a file on that. So what they did was Jim and Howard went out, and they went around and put the corners in. So came back in, and he had this map. And at the time when he brought it in, we were on Second Avenue still. Jim Binkley, and did you know P.J. Sullivan, the guy that was the main title guy for the pipeline? I mean, a smart, cool guy. So, and he knew about meets and bounds description. And that's all I did meets and bounds description every day of my life. I mean, I was just wonderful, just good at Sullivan. So the three, these three brains look at this and come up with a meets and bounds description. And when the application came in, the BIA files it. We had written it, filed it. It was rejected by the BIA because it didn't close. And sure enough, and I don't know how we managed that. Yeah. Yeah, so we had to re-describe it. Yeah. And then he, you know, it took a while to answer, but he didn't care about a certificate of allotment. But one day when they brought that new discovery in, and they went down the river, they brought in their new bigger boat.
Yeah.
So instead of 75 people, it was like 550.
Yeah.
And so Howard said that Howard's a super guy. And he said he looked out there and saw half the city of Cleveland coming across his property. And and Jim realized that too, was kind of poor form. So that's when they stopped going to his his place.
Yeah.
And then not much longer after that, they stopped having the fish camps from, well, since the boat didn't come down, they couldn't sell their artwork and stuff. Yeah. And that's one of the places we went when that woman came up about federal land from Nebraska, because they have a museum there, a homesteaders museum somewhere. And that's what she was. And we went out to see him. We went out and visited Howard, which was a neat trip.
Well, let's stop here.
Sure.
And now look over what you've said and come back and say, hey, how about
No. More was available that anyone could find this stuff out, but I really am pessimistic. You ought to just, for the heck of it, think of something that you want to research and go out there and See what you find out. The guys that operate the computers, Kanisha is the one who runs the, and she's pretty good, but she worked in fire control until she got the job there. And but she's the one that just didn't got rid of all the microfilms of the township plats, so you can't look at a status plat. And it's just because she came along later in the day. But the two guys that they have on the are very helpful and very nice, but they wouldn't know anything. They don't even know what a native allotment is. I was trying to get something plotted correctly on the status plats and just couldn't do it. They just didn't have much. They knew there were 5 or 6 survey meridians and stuff, but as far as knowing much of anything about, you know, oil and gas, you know, and if you don't have an historical index, but I think you can print those up there. But if there are mistakes on them, see, it used to be when we first went into, I was there for 4 or 5 years when we had computers, and the system was when you found an error, which you found a lot, you simply sent a message to the guy in Anchorage who was in charge of computers. I say, it should be section 3, not section 10 or something, and it'd be changed, because all he had to do was like that.
Mm-hmm.
But see, he had been a person, or they, the person in that office, that had worked around people, and they knew people filed homesteads and oil and allotments, so it meant something. If one day someone says, well, why bother to change that? Who gives a shit? And it used to be that you could find out stuff with all the case files back in the drawer. You could look at an old status plat and see what it looked like in 1968 or something and find out things, but I don't know. I just don't think that there's ever going to be any, much of a history, which is really too bad.
Yeah. Okay.
But you ought to go out there. You ought to go out there and just...
well, I've been to the public room and I've always been disappointed, yeah.
It is. It was a disappointment.
Yeah.